Today's discussion will have its moment of sadness. There's no question. Our guest and her husband lost one of their three kids to a rare genetic disorder. Charlotte was the six-year-old middle child of Suki Forbes and her husband, Michael Bigham. Suki Forbes' book about Charlotte's death and the process of grieving and recovering is called The Angel in My Pocket, a story of love, loss, and life after death. It is freshly out in a paperback edition. It is the first book by Suki Forbes. Suki lectures on positive grief and embracing life after loss. She's also the founder of an art and collectibles company and a blogger for the Huffington Post. Suki Forbes, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Charlotte sounds like a really, she was an interesting person. I mean, the middle child who ruled the roost, you call her. Why?
She did. She really was a feisty one. In hindsight, I think that she really wanted to pack in a whole lot of living in her six short years. And boy, did she ever. She led her older brother and her younger sister around into all sorts of good-natured mischief that was both a joy and a terror to watch as a parent.
No doubt. There's a reference in the book and a picture in the Boston Globe of you with two different color loafers, and that's also a reference to Charlotte. What is that about?
Oh, you know, she had a wonderful sense of color and fashion. And we were at a clothing store one day, and she was buying new shoes, and she was trying on these little loafers, and she tried on the red pair, and she tried on the green pair, and she wanted both because she wanted to wear one of each. And I thought it was really adorable and figured I would indulge her. And very wisely, this clothing store also carried mommy sizes, and so I bought the same two pairs of shoes. And quite regularly, we would both wear those shoes, and I still do it a lot. And it's, you know, people think it's rather crazy. They're sort of sidebar whispering, do you think that she knows she's wearing two different color shoes? But, you know, Charlotte started that, and I do it to continue to honor her.
It's a wonderful little homage to her. Plus, there's also the punchline of the old joke, you can tell people you have another pair just like it at home.
Uh-huh, exactly.
We get a great sense of place from the beginning of The Angel in My Pocket. Tell us about Naushon Island, not the least of which is, where is it?
Well, it's an island in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, far east coast, very far from here. And it's largely been preserved in its natural state for the last 150 years. And so it really feels very much like a national park. There are no cars. There are no stores. And it's been a place that my family has gone for quite some time and has really been a source of both healing and feeling and communing with nature. And for me, that was a very important place in my grieving, although I think that anybody can find a specific space that that they go to where they can sink down into themselves. But for me, it was that space in particular that was quite healing.
That was the place you needed to be after Charlotte died?
I had to go there right away. We had been there 3 days before, swimming and playing and doing all sorts of family summer activities. And I didn't want to make that. I wanted to diffuse the charge that might have had about going back. And so it was really important to me to face that head on and sort of recreate our family relationship with the space, so that it wasn't going to be too hard to go back, because it had been a place I'd gone all of my life, and I wanted my children to continue to go there and have good memories of it. So we went right away and spent a good week there right after she died.
And way back, not just in your life, but in the lives of many other people in your family. How long has the Forbes family called the island home?
Since the mid-1850s.
Wow.
Yeah, long time.
And there are some notable family friends and even some, well, lots of interesting relatives as well.
Yes. I come from a very long line of New England Yankees, going back to pretty much the first couple of boats that came over. And one of the more notable ones is Ralph Waldo Emerson, who, when I was in my early stages of grief, I turned to family writings, because I was raised in a family that didn't do a whole lot of talking of emotions and feelings. But did a fair amount of writing about it, so I turned to family papers. And there was obviously a lot of Emerson's writings around, both publicly and privately. And very quickly I came upon or rediscovered that he had also lost a child to a high fever, which is how my daughter Charlotte had died, at the age of six. And my daughter Charlotte had died at the age of six. So instantly, there was this really powerful kinship that I felt with him, and his writings took on a new meaning, and I just dove right in and felt really as though he held my hand through much of the process.
So, wow. So a great help from somebody within the family, in a sense. But this you mentioned the New England, the Yankee family that went back to the first couple of boats. People may not understand just how significant Forbes and Saltonstall are as family names in New England.
Yeah. Well, they were, you know, the Saltonstalls came over on the Winthrop fleet, which was the second set of boats that came over, and the Forbeses were the sort of Johnny come latelys. They didn't show up until I think until the mid 1700s, but they were, yeah, so they were the
latecomers, yeah,
right. Exactly. But they were really, you know, back, you know, the world was a smaller place then, and New England and Boston in particular was a very small town. And everybody knew everybody else, and there was a very powerful culture of sort of sticking together and really powering through some strong hardships, particularly in the beginning. And I think that real puritanical work ethic was certainly powerfully passed down traditionally through my family, as well as some of the religious teachings or lack thereof. And that was both helpful, both of those, the culture of being very stoic and also the sort of Unitarian way of thinking, which is sort of one God at most. Both of those were helpful and yet also very difficult for me in terms of finding ways to get in touch with my own emotions and grief and what it meant to be a bereaved parent and where the heck did my child go? That was a very big part of my early grief.
That one reads big, the idea of like, okay, my child is not here, but where is she? And we'll pick that up on the other side of a break. The book is called The Angel in My Pocket, A Story of Love, Loss, and Life After Death. Suki Forbes wrote it. It's now out in paperback. And you can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange when we return in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Suki Forbes, the author of the book The Angel in My Pocket, A Story of Love, Loss, and Life After Death. Suki and her husband Michael Bigham had three kids. Charlotte died at age 6, just about 11 years ago. And the recovery, the long road back to a quote-unquote normal life is reflected in the book, The Angel in My Pocket. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Suki, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the level of reserve that you got from your Rock Rib New England family. And I swear, when I first flipped the book open randomly, I ran across the section where you called wasps God's frozen people. In the sense that they really, so just within, it sounds like generations back in the family, there was just a lot of reserve, stoicism, you said.
Well, yes, there was. And I do think that that was probably required, particularly early on in the settling of America. There were very hard, the conditions were very difficult and they had to band together and be very tough. And that culture really was passed down. And I was talking about just before the break how challenging that was in terms of feeling as though I wasn't really allowed to come unglued during the grief. And one thing I've learned after 11 years is that many of us feel as though we've done it wrong. And boy, my husband did grief at least initially the way I thought was right, that, you know, he came unglued and was weeping and did all of those things and was sort of unable to function for a period of time. And I walked around like a zombie, feeling as though I just had to keep going. And it was terrifying to me and I'm sure horrifying to people who watched me. And I really struggled with that and also struggled with that age-old dilemma of what happens when we die and where do we go? And I had to answer that question in terms of where was my daughter before I allowed myself even the potential luxury of feeling any pain or sorrow. And so a lot of my early days were focused on what happened to all of that energy and exuberance and life and love. How could it just vaporize and be gone completely? And so much of my searching was both spiritually and emotionally and scientifically trying to figure out, where do we go?
Was it almost an academic sort of quest?
Well, I think it was, because I'm guardedly skeptical about most of my research, and I come from a line of lots of people who are rather academic in focus. And so on the one hand, I was willing to consider absolutely anything, any possibility at all of where my daughter might be, particularly if it meant I might be able to get in touch with her in some way. But on the other, I didn't want to be taken advantage of, and I wanted to be realistic. And I think we see just three dimensions here. So why would I believe there was something else? I had never been raised to believe that there was a heaven or a hell or another dimension or any of those places. So I walked down that path of exploration, and I would say it was somewhat academic and yet also very open-minded. And I want to be really clear that I do believe that one of the real keys to moving through grief or any real personal challenge that knocks us to our knees, and we all have them, is that you've got to take the position of being really open-minded to other places that might bring you comfort. And so for me, it was listening to other ideas about where she might be and what belief systems might exist. And then, but also in tandem with that, it was finding a way to be very quiet and listen to myself and to that inner voice that also has an awful lot of information if we choose to listen to it. And I think both of those are really key to any of us moving through a personal crisis.
Suki Forbes is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Angel in My Pocket, now out in paperback. Let's talk about the circumstances. It was a different vacation, not on Nauchon Island, but on the Outer Banks of the Carolinas, where Charlotte suffered her first bout of malignant hyperthermia, which is a revelation, I think, that just about anybody reads the book, with the possible exception of a pediatrician, and not many of those, apparently.
Well, you know, when I speak of malignant hyperthermia, and I won't go into this for too long, it's very unusual anyway, and it usually only presents in an operating room. Her presentation of it was highly, highly rare. About 11 years ago, she was one of only about 5 or 6 cases. So often I will be gently taken on by physicians. But let's just put that aside for a second, because it's actually sort of inconsequential because she still passed. But she had her first episode of this very high fever that was unable to be regulated, when we were in North Carolina. And we, at the time, it seemed very much by coincidence, happened to be with my sister-in-law and brother-in-law, both of whom are physicians, one who is a pediatric anesthesiologist. And she said the next day, after having an IV bag and being able to treat her in the middle of nowhere, she said, "I got to tell you, what I saw really terrified me, and I think this is what she has, and it's a crazy presentation, and people are going to think you're crazy, and there's really the only way to treat this is by management." And, you know, denial is a pretty powerful thing. I mean, we spent a long time managing her fevers, but that little voice in the back of my head didn't really believe that this is what she had. It just seemed too rare. And yet 2 years almost to the day later, she had another episode. Because we knew that this was her issue, we went straight to the emergency room. She was treated properly, and yet she didn't really have a chance.
I'm surprised, and I have already warned listeners at the very top of the hour, this is a book you need to read with something dry to absorb your tears. It's quite moving, but I'm surprised you remember the details of the day so well. I mean, did you have to remember them later because you were in such a fog at the time?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I actually, the chapter of the day that she died, I wrote almost in one sitting. And I've reviewed it once or twice, and it's been edited once or twice. It's very raw. It's powerful, and I remember it. It is seared in my brain. I want to be really clear, though. It is, I believe, I think the best memoir and the best stories go deep and are very truthful. And I worked very hard to write from that place. But I was very careful about when I chose to write The Angel in My Pocket, because this book and this type of resource didn't exist for me when I was moving through. And that was very frustrating, because yes, it's very sad, particularly the chapter when I describe she dies, but the entire trajectory of the book goes all the way through and then to the far side of recovery and fully embracing life. And that was the piece that was very important to me. So I do think that being honest about the entire process is really, really key. But my primary motivation in putting this book together was having a resource out there for people who were maybe on the early stages and looking for some sort of a lifeline that said, life will someday be better, and possibly even better than it was when you lost your loved one, if you choose to do the work and allow that to be so. So I'm rather proud of the fact that it has brought many people to tears, and yet I often will read the ending at book readings because people are expecting the sorrowful piece, but they're not expecting the uplifting and powerful and resilient ending, which is really why I wrote the book to begin with.
It is a moving book at that. The Angel in My Pocket, A Story of Love, Loss, and Life After Death. Suki Forbes is the author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join this discussion, 800-838-3760, throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned not having a resource out there like this. But there are books out there, but they tend to be more technical, like you should do this after 6 weeks. And I mean, they tend to sort of just guide you rather than tell a story as you did.
Well, I think that's true. And in hindsight, I will say that a lot of the books out there tend to be written by therapists or people who are serving the bereaved. Now, I want to say I am a big fan of talk therapy and any sort of therapy that works. But a lot of these books, I felt, were either written by people who were in grief or written by people who were servicing people who were grieving. And many of them lacked that final resting point of fully being back in the flow of life and feeling good. And gosh, when you are down in the trenches and you're in the library or in a bookstore and you just want to find one example of somebody who's fought their way through this and out to the other side and says, I'm better than I was before, and deeper and kinder and more empathic and a better human being and parent on all levels, I wanted that book desperately. And the fact that it didn't exist made me feel as though it wasn't possible. And many people had said, and I would say that 99% of the people just want to be helpful and kind, but sometimes say the really difficult things, but they would say, so-and-so lost a child, and they were never the same. And the subtext of that was never the same, as in some sort of attenuated version of who you were before, but never really back to a wonderful state of living. And that felt to me like a death sentence in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at that now, and it was frustrating to me at the time, and I just think that does a disservice to people. I mean, living and dying are parts of being human, and we've been experiencing loss since the beginning of time. And we are programmed to be resilient, and we need to give ourselves permission to feel the pain, which the only way out is letting it work through you. But we need to give ourselves permission to, on the far side, learn from all of that suffering and be better. And it's not impossible. It's not even difficult. It just takes time. And I was really frustrated. And again, earlier I said that I felt that I was wrong going through grief.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us, I believe, move through our grieving process or our challenges and think, I'm doing this all wrong. And the only way to do it wrong is to not do it at all. But there needed to be more examples out there. And it has been incredibly gratifying to hear from people how much this has helped them and how much this has been a lifeline for them. And my story is not unique. I just believe that it is unique from the perspective of writing it as a look back through the whole process so that somebody can say, oh, look, there's a person who made it, and I can be a person who made it. I'm not any different than anybody else who's gone through grief. I just chose to live and chose to get there one day, and I chart that out in the book.
You had some good family members and friends around you to help right from the very beginning. And tell us about your friend Sarah and how she was a help to you right away. And, in fact, you helped each other.
No one's asked me about her. That's not really her name. Sarah was a dear friend for many years, and we went through, our lives moved in fairly parallel ways. We had children at the same time, married at the same time, enjoyed the same activities, and she lost a son 3 years prior to me losing a child. And I'm not sure I was very helpful to her going through that process. I think that we expect that people will be quote-unquote done with grieving after about a year, and you're never done, which is a daunting thing to hear. It changes, and it's not unrelenting, but it's always there. And she was very, very helpful at walking me through the process and letting me know how her experience was and sort of shining a light on certain areas. Maybe consider going down this path or that path. She was very helpful for me in terms of my religious explorations and recommending of books. So she was a very dear friend and remains one to this day.
Suki Forbes, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Angel in My Pocket, A Story of Love, Loss, and Life After Death. The process that, I mean, the whole idea of putting one foot in front of the other to continue on in your own life after you've lost someone so dear to you. What were some of the daily routines you did in the weeks after Charlotte died?
Well, I think we all need to do what works best for us. But I will tell you that for me, and very much the culture, sort of the Emersonian and Yankee culture, is nothing like a brisk walk to sort of bring you back into focus. And so I really just took to the woods, and I would go out and jog and walk for long periods of time. And I do think that grief and sorrow manifests itself in us on the cellular level, and breathing and just getting out and moving is a way of just moving it through our system, even if we don't even think we're processing it. And early on one of these walks, it became really clear to me that I had only three choices. I could die, I could exist, or I could live. And boy, did I want to die. And if you talk to any parent, one of the very first things they will say when they learn that you've lost a child is, I'd die if that happened to me. And guess what? I wanted to die too, but I didn't get to. And existing, which is something that many of us do even without being bereaved or in a personal crisis, just sort of reacting and moving through our days, that seemed to me to be a death sentence in and of itself. I wanted to believe I would see my daughter again. I wanted that time to pass quickly between the moment when she had died and the moment when I'd see her again. And the best way that it seemed to make that time pass was to live. And also, I had two surviving children and a husband, and they deserved to have a good life. And so the only thing that made sense to me was to live. And all I could do in that moment on the walk was to choose to want to live. And that right there defined how I continued to move through the world.
That's an interesting two-step removal, to want to live. You hadn't quite gotten to...
What was the best I could come up with?
Yeah.
And so we just did things like, we had the birthday parties for the kids. We were at back to school night. We just faked it. We just showed up. And I think that showing up is a way of slowly teaching your brain how to rewire itself. And I'm sure it wasn't pretty, and I'm sure we missed a lot of stuff, and I'll tell you, we ate a lot of pizza and bad food, but we kept moving, and eventually certain things started to feel normal again. And I wanted to be happy, but happy is a fleeting thing as well. And one way that I have discovered that you can come sideways into living and embracing life and happiness is to not focus on the word happy, but to focus on the word awe. And getting out into nature or finding things that are larger and beautiful and instill a sense of awe, that's a way of sideways getting at happiness. And all of those moments, they continue to add up, and it's like they feed something inside of you. And one day, you wake up and you feel a little bit better. And that time between the moment of waking up and not remembering and remembering gets stretched out longer and longer. But it takes a concerted effort, and it takes a lot of showing up and faking it till you make it. It really does.
It's one of many powerful observations in the book, the sense of waking up in the morning and then the reality returning, and then knowing that that does get longer over time. We have to take a break right now. We'll come back and talk more with Suki Forbes about The Angel in My Pocket, a story of love, loss, and life after death. Back with Suki and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Suki Forbes. She lectures on positive grief and embracing life after loss. She and husband Michael Bigham lost one of their three kids to a rare genetic disorder at age 6, 11 years ago. She's written a book about that called The Angel in My Pocket, a story of love, loss, and life after death, about the long process of recovering from the process of grieving. Suki Forbes, our guest on The Exchange. You can join us at 800-838-3760 around the region. And by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Suki, we already mentioned that not long after Charlotte's death, you brought the family back to the ancestral home at Naushon Island. And there's such history in that mansion, and an address book, a guest book that goes back to like the mid-1800s from the creation of the house itself. And lots of information about previous relatives. Robert Swain, a cousin of the Forbes, his story apparently had quite an influence on you. What did you learn about him?
Oh, he had one of those, very romantic tubercular deaths of the 19th century. And he was a cousin, and he was sent down to Florida because he was not well, and in this very romantic journey coming back north as he was on his sort of final days of his life, and his mother was headed south to meet him, and unfortunately she never connected with him. But he had a very powerful near-death experience during one of his coughing spells, and he writes about it, and it's the very first family near-death experience that I had read about, where he talks about really sort of going to quote-unquote the other side and not wanting to come back and feeling this great sense of peace. And again, I said earlier, I so struggled with where my daughter had gone. I wanted to know that she went somewhere and that some essence of her still remained and would remain, and I'd see her again, and that she was happy. And all mothers want their children to be well cared for. I had to know she was being cared for. So to read about Robert going to this place that felt so blissful and embracing was comforting to me.
And you mentioned that reorganizing Charlotte's bathroom led to the episode that led to the title of the book. What did you find in her bathroom?
Well, I will tell you the story backwards, which is, again, we need to be very open-minded, I believe, extremely open-minded to other ways of finding comfort. And it comes in very different ways. And I really pushed the fringes on it out of my desperation and curiosity. And somebody suggested that I contact a psychic medium who is someone who can talk to people on, quote-unquote, the other side. And I thought, okay, that's crazy, but if I can be in touch with my daughter, I'm willing to try anything. And I went to one of these sessions, and I was one of 500 in a room, and she went around and said she took what she called validations from people, and she ultimately came around to me and started describing my daughter in very vivid detail. And she said, if I'm talking about one of your loved ones, put your hand up. And eventually, I had to put my hand up. It was just so clear she was talking about Charlotte. And she proceeded to tell me all sorts of things about my children and my husband and our home and our extended family and about Charlotte. And then she said she wants to acknowledge a small, white, sparkly thing, ornament, something like that, that you carry with you. And she says that she placed it somewhere for you. And shortly after Charlotte had died, we had just moved into a new house, and it had been completely empty, and we'd painted it top to bottom. And I was unpacking things in her bathroom, and this is after she had passed. And way on the top in the back of a shelf, I reached in and I found this tiny angel that was about 1 inch tall, sort of holiday ornament, a little bit sparkly. And I took one look at it, and I just knew that it was a sign from Charlotte. I just knew. And I put it in my pocket thinking, well, I'll just hold on to it for now. And I ended up holding on to that I had it for a couple of years. And it had been several months at this time when the medium brought this up. I had not told a soul, not my husband, not my children, not anybody about this angel. And here is this woman sitting in front of me describing the angel that I carry around in my pocket and saying that my daughter had placed it there for me. So this is where the title, The Angel in My Pocket, comes from. And I could and will, if you like, go into greater detail, but it was so clear to me in that session that some essence of who Charlotte was right there and then talking to me through this medium. And I completely shifted in that moment, knowing that she was okay and that she was there. And for me, that was a really critical piece in being able to then focus on my own personal grief and not where my child was and is she okay.
But as you pointed out already, you come to this with a great deal of skepticism, don't you? I mean, just the general sense of being able to contact people on the other side?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm fairly realistic. I see what's in front of me. The idea that all these people were circling all around and were accessible, I thought that sounded rather magical and interesting. And I was open to it in concept, but in reality, I wanted cold, hard proof. And that was cold, hard proof for me. And so much so that I then made another appointment with her and went in for a private session and proceeded to then get an entire hour's worth of extraordinary information, not just about Charlotte, but about other family members. And for those who say that these people are mind readers, she told me things that I didn't even know about. And she said them with such confidence that it actually sort of cracked me up. I recorded it. But she'd say, oh, no, you go check on that. Or I'd say, I have no idea what you're talking about. She'd say, well, you go check. Write it down. You go check. And I would go check, and she would be right. She told me about a horse that was buried in my backyard. I had no idea. She told me about certain flowers that had been planted in my yard. I told her that they were one color. She said that they were another. She said, you go check. She was right. I was wrong. I mean, it was very, very hard to dismiss that this woman had some extra sense, some extra ability that I didn't and that many people don't. And it was really extraordinary is the best way I can describe it.
And Suki, was this something you did alone or did Michael take part or the kids?
Michael went with me the second time. I was so bowled over by the group experience. I actually sat in my car for a couple of hours and couldn't drive. It was actually in a hotel about an hour from our house, and I almost got a room. And I ultimately drove home, and I was so charged up by this experience that, again, when you are in that place of desperation, we become highly vulnerable and susceptible, so we need to be very careful. But again, we also become open-minded. And he wanted some of what I had just had. I mean, I really felt as though I had had a powerful interaction with our daughter. And so he was willing to try it. And I can't speak entirely for him, but I will say that the experience of both of us going to see this woman for the private session gave both of us a strong sense that she knew exactly what she was talking about and that she was in touch with our daughter. And there is no way she could have found this information out on a Google search or a background check. I mean, this was a young child. There was nothing in the paper. We were very private people. So this is information that she would have had no ability to collect on her own.
All right, let's take a call here. We have John in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Suki Forbes, the author of The Angel in My Pocket.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Here in Grants Pass, we have a girl, Allison Johnson. She's 7. She's back at St. Jude's with a rare form of cancer called Ewing sarcoma. And I guess my question is for your guest is, boy, that must be so difficult to go through all this. But second, I hope it's okay if I mention this, Applegate River Golf Course is having a tournament to benefit their family on Saturday. Mm-hmm. And if anybody is interested, any of our listeners, we need more people to play. It's a 9-hole tournament, and the money goes directly to their family. You know, I understand St. Jude's is fantastic to hear everybody, but as far as getting back and forth from Tennessee and other things, it must be very difficult. Right. So if anybody's interested, there's a website, Applegate River Golf Course, that has all the information about Allison, what she's going through. And anyway, that's, if your guests would like to make a comment on it, that'd be great. Thank
all right. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it.
Well, I will say I'm so sorry to hear about that. And, you know, I think the death of a child and an out-of-sequence loss is so jarring. And one of the things that I really experienced so powerfully, and we did as a family, is the real groundswell of support of the community. And that's very healing in and of itself, is to feel the embrace of a greater community. And I'm sorry that it takes tragedies like a 9/11 or the death of a child to rally us all together, but it is really comforting to see that level of humanity and that level of caring and empathy expressed.
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was bound to make an appearance in this book. I mean, she's the one who codified the 5 stages of grief. But you point out that some of the other things she got into later in her career, which go more into the realm we've just been talking about.
Well, I have to say, I did come into Kubler-Ross again, going into the bookstores and the libraries looking for a roadmap. And she, Kubler-Ross, who is, as you know, the founder of the hospice movement, did come up with these 5 stages. And they've become somewhat the gold standard for moving through grief. However, they were created for people coming to terms with their own mortality. And they don't necessarily apply to those of us moving through grief. So I will say that although in the beginning I was very much a fan of Kubler-Ross, and I still am in many ways, I think that her 5 stages of grief do us a bit of a disservice because we don't always go through all of them. And I remember personally thinking, well, I'm not in anger, so until I feel anger, I'm not, quote-unquote, done. We don't all go through the 5 stages, and we certainly don't go through them in a linear way. However, the more I read about Kubler-Ross, the more I did feel an affinity to her. And her later works that unfortunately got her a little bit more discredited by her peers and the medical community really take another step into these other dimensions and life after death. And she had some pretty powerful experiences. I believe she writes about it in On Life After Death, where she, too, is having communications with people on the other side. And people who attend people's bedsides at the end of their life fairly regularly will report powerful experiences that the person who is passing have with some sorts of communications with people on the other side. And they're often dismissed as being in some sort of reverie or just sort of out of it from the drugs or whatever it is. But there are too many there's too much anecdotal data of these people who are actually having conversations. I experienced it actually with my grandfather, where they feel their loved ones are coming for them. And I find that very powerful. I will say that Ralph Waldo Emerson's last words as he lay on his deathbed were, "That boy, that beautiful boy." Now, my personal belief is he was looking right at his six-year-old son, Waldo, just as he passed, that his six-year-old son had come to him. And we all have different belief systems, and I am not asking people to accept mine as full reality. My point in writing about it is more that we need to be open-minded to places that bring us comfort. And for somebody else, it could be a completely different area. But for me, I've certainly found great comfort in exploring what happens on that other side. And so for me to read about Kubler-Ross, who I had a high regard for, going to that place as well, that was very comforting to me.
So, Suki, it sounds like it's not really like you've done a 180 from any previously held sets of beliefs, but more like just continued in a direction that allowed a greater latitude. You consider more things possible now.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I was always open-mindedly skeptical about many ways of thinking. I mean, when you grow up in an old house with lots of family members and lots of traditions, we had ghosts. If you asked anybody individually if they believed in ghosts, they'd probably say no, and yet many people had experiences either seeing or feeling some other presence in the room. So there was some sense throughout my childhood that there was more than just what we see, but not a powerful sense that, we didn't talk about it so much. That's something I came to through my own personal explorations with trying to get comfort with where my daughter had gone. And for me, it worked.
It's a pretty amazing book, The Angel in My Pocket, A Story of Love, Loss, and Life After Death, now out in paperback. Suki Forbes wrote it and joined us today on The Exchange. And Suki, for that, we thank you greatly.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, take care.